Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Tonight, the country is mourning a civil rights icon. Reverend Jesse Jackson has died at the age of 84. For decades, Jackson fought for communities of color on issues like voting rights and job opportunities. After sharing his Parkinson's diagnosis in 2017, he continued to make public appearances and run his Rainbow Push organization until stepping down in 2023. But late last year, his doctors confirmed a diagnosis of supranuclear palsy, a life-threatening neurological disorder. Here's a look at just some of his journey.
If there is any doubt in anybody's mind concerning whether we have a movement here in Chicago, you ought to be in this church tonight.
From Martin Luther King Jr. to President Barack Obama, Reverend Jesse Jackson's 84 years spanned generations from the civil rights movement to the nation's first black president, and so much history in between. Jackson was born in 1941 in Greenville, South Carolina. As a student at the historically black university, North Carolina A&T, he led sit-ins at whites-only lunch counters and became immersed in a burgeoning civil rights movement, eventually joining the march from Selma to Montgomery, led by Reverend King. King eventually dispatched the young Jackson to Chicago to run Operation Breadbasket, an economic campaign pressuring white businesses to hire black workers. 4 years later, Jackson stood outside the Lorraine Motel as he and other icons of the movement witnessed King's assassination.
It was a very traumatic moment. I don't know how we held it together. It was one of those deafening moments where AM becomes PM and life becomes before and after Martin Luther King. All that stuff happened within such a split second.
But after the assassination, when Jackson returned to Chicago, other King aides criticized him for wearing a sweater supposedly soaked with King's blood for 2 days after the shooting. In 1971, Jackson formed Operation Push on Chicago's South Side with a mission to register voters in communities of color nationwide and diversify the workforce. He would again write his name in the history books with not one but two campaigns for president. The second run in 1988, winning 13 primaries and caucuses for the Democratic nomination.
We must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive.
Keep hope more than alive. Any other black politician until Barack Obama.
And I don't think I and many other people realize to what extent Jesse Jackson paved the way, not just in the tactics of politics, the delegates and all of that stuff. That sounds very wonky to a lot of people, but also in the message, in the vision that he had of unity in a Democratic coalition, of using all the different parts of the rainbow of America and putting them together in one political party. He was largely responsible for that. And frankly, in the 1980s, no one realized that. Because it wasn't until Barack Obama became president that I think people started to realize, oh wait, Jesse Jackson actually did something that lasted beyond those two campaigns.
Over the years, Jackson continued his fight for voting rights and to register as many people as he could. He exerted influence abroad, garnering the release of hundreds of captives, and at home, standing with families like those of Ahmaud Arbery, the black jogger killed by three white men in Georgia in 2021. Jackson was known for his flair with words, his unmistakable cadence, so much that he even got in on the joke of it on a 1983 episode of Saturday Night Live.
You do not like green eggs and ham? I do not like them. Sam, I am.
Though sometimes his words got him in trouble, as when he apologized for using a derogatory reference to the Jewish population of New York in 1984. And in 2008, complaining that candidate Barack Obama was, quote, talking down to black people. The ordained minister also acknowledged fathering a daughter outside of his marriage with one of his Rainbow Push employees. In 2018, we had the chance to ask him about his own legacy.
What do you think your legacy will be, Reverend Jackson?
Well, you know, Brandis, I've sought to continue the service. I'm a person of faith. Faith must fight on just law.
Even then, he was still focused on what more he could do.
Our time has come. We've come from this grace to amazing grace. Our time has come. Give me your tithe. Give me your poor, your huddled masses who yearn to breathe free. And come November, there will be a change because our time has come. Thank you and God bless you.
Jackson leaves behind his wife of 63 years, Jacqueline Jackson, and their children, Santita, Jesse Jr., Jonathan, Yusuf, and Jacqueline as well. Jacqueline, yes, another Jacqueline, as well as daughter Ashley Jackson and grandchildren. In a statement, the family says, quote, "Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world. We ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by." The Rainbow Push Coalition says public observances will be held here in Chicago and that details will be shared in the coming days. And reactions are pouring in today. In a statement, Mayor Brandon Johnson says, quote, "I am devastated to lose my mentor and friend, Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. We honor him and his hard-earned legacy as a freedom fighter, philosopher, and faithful shepherd of his family and community here in Chicago." Former President Barack Obama says, for more than 60 years, Reverend Jackson helped lead some of the most significant movements for change in human history. Michelle got her first glimpse of political organizing at the Jackson's kitchen table when she was a teenager. And in his two historic runs for president, he laid the foundation for my own campaign to the highest office of the land. On Truth Social, President Donald Trump posted in part, quote, "I knew him well long before becoming president. He was a good man with lots of personality, grit, and, quote, street smarts. He was very gregarious, someone who truly loved people. He had much to do with the election without acknowledgement or credit of Barack Hussein Obama, a man who Jesse could not stand." And president of the Chicago Teachers Union and Illinois Federation of Teachers, Stacey Davis Gates, says, quote, "He marched with educators, students, and families. He walked picket lines. He fought for the schools our children deserve. His leadership expanded the map of possibility." There's more reaction on our website. You can find it at WTTW.com/news, and you can get more reaction by staying right here because up next, a look at the life and legacy of Reverend Jesse Jackson and his deep roots in Chicago with some who knew him well. Stay with us.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Reverend Jesse Jackson's legacy runs deep in Chicago. He left his mark on generations of politicians, clergy members, organizers, and everyday folks. Joining us to talk about Jesse Jackson are Sixth Ward Alderman William Hall, who represents communities like Chatham, Auburn Gresham, and parts of Englewood. Reverend Jeanette Wilson, senior advisor to Reverend Jackson at the Rainbow Push Coalition. And Kevin Boyle, professor of American history at Northwestern University. Welcome to all three of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you
my
so
condolences.
Much
I know that you were very close to Reverend Jackson. Reverend Wilson, I want to start with you. As we watched that obit package and sort of a look back over some of the years, what comes to mind for you? What are your favorite memories?
Well, I think Reverend Jackson continued the legacy that Dr. King left. He began his ministry talking about the Poor People's Campaign. He became mayor of Resurrection City, leaving what Dr. King started on his last birthday, a campaign to have the nation look at the plight of poor people, brown, black, white, yellow, all of those poor people met Reverend Jackson in D.C. They came in mule trains and across the country, fighting for fair housing, fighting for a livable wage, fighting for access to health care for themselves and for their children. So he started there. He's a prophetic voice that fought for everyone. He really believed in this Rainbow Coalition. He fought for students to have a high quality public education at every level of the educational scale. He fought for teachers to be certified in the city of Chicago. He fought for access for business people to have access for their products to be on store shelves. He fought for consumers to understand the buying power that we have. And he would tell corporations, if we represent 10% of your market, you owe us 10% of your jobs and contracts. And he fought that all around the nation. Then he fought for a freedom in America and abroad. He met Nelson Mandela at Robben Island in prison. He was with Nelson Mandela when he was released because he fought to end apartheid. He was with Mandela when he became president. He went to countries all over the world freeing hostages. We often said if we ever traveled, we didn't worry about it because we said if something happened, Reverend Jackson would come and get us. We don't even know how he did it. He got Lieutenant Goodman. Nobody was even looking for him. Reverend Jackson went and rescued him.
Is there a memory that you have of him that really illustrates what he means to people, to anyone?
I went to Tunica, Mississippi, which is where Tunica used to be called Sugar Dish, the poorest city in America. They didn't have a sewage cleanup problem. They didn't have running clean water filtration. Reverend Jackson walked into this little house, one-room house with a lady sitting in the middle of the room, roaches everywhere. It was just, the smell was unbelievable. In Mississippi, which is now where they gamble. And he said, this is unfair for this woman to sit in this house living like this. Garbage was thrown in the ditch in front of her home. And so she couldn't have she didn't have access to health care, she didn't have access to clean water. And he painted a picture of her for the world to see so that America would have to fix it. He said, this is not right. Nobody else had been to the house, no governor, no mayor, no county board president. And he wasn't a candidate at that time, an ordinary prophetic voice that said, this is not right for people to live like this.
Alderman Hall, how did you come to know him?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's her. We were in the basement at Rainbow Push shooting Sunday School on her Sunday School broadcast. And she says to me, I think that you need to come back on Saturday and open up the broadcast. Didn't know what the broadcast was, never heard of
the degree. How old were you at the time? Were you?
I was, about 24, 25.
Okay, so young adult.
And I walk out the hallway with Reverend Wilson, and there's Reverend Jackson. And she tells Reverend Jackson that I'm going to be back on Saturday to open up the broadcast. And I'll never forget, I came with a V-neck shirt and, you know, this I didn't know what to do. And Reverend looked at me and said, this is not Miami Vice. You're getting ready to talk to the world. And it was that moment that he allowed me to clear my throat and say something to the world. And from that moment over, for the rest of my life, I will always remember the world that he created for me and showed me.
Professor Boyle, what do you view as Reverend Jackson's most enduring contribution to American political as well as civil rights history?
I think there are two things that really stand out to me. The most obvious one is he was this transformational figure. He was a bridge between that extraordinary generation that took the civil rights movement into its greatest breakthroughs, and then the age of Obama at the other side. He's the bridge between those. He's the man who made it possible for America to transition from Jim Crow America to Barack Obama's America. But I think your story was so powerful that the other side of Jesse Jackson's story, which I think deserves so much more attention, is being a voice for people who had every reason to believe in this society that they didn't have a voice. Mm-hmm. The ability to give people who had reason to have no hope in this nation, hope in this nation. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a really powerful thing to hear people say that he was a great patriot, because of course that's the very definition of patriotism, that you represent what's best in the American promise and become a voice for people to share in that hope.
Alderman Hall, Reverend Jackson was both a faith leader and a politician, yeah. Lots of other things as we've discussed, Reverend Wilson. But you share those two things as well. You're an alderman as well as a faith leader. What lessons do you borrow from him, be it, you know, either in the church or working as an alderman?
Yeah, first, the best sermon you will ever preach is to show up and care for those who are in need. And that was the sermon that he preached when there was no camera, That was the sermon he preached at 2 o'clock in the morning when he got a phone call from someone who didn't have clothes because their home was burned out. And that sermon is a sermon that I'm still trying to preach, which is to show up and to care for those who are in need. And what Reverend Jackson did for all of us is to show us what the Bible looked like. His son, Representative Jackson, Jonathan, said earlier, my daddy at heart is a minister. And when I say to you that when it comes to the Bible, he lived it. Mm-hmm. And many a days on a flight, many a days, a long day in the car, that Bible was right there in his hand. Mm-hmm. And not only was he a student of the words, he was a student that learned how to love. And he showed that love in spaces where most people said, don't go. He showed a love to people who didn't have a voice. And those are not just, you know, talking points that you will hear throughout the days. That was his reality. He believed in the mission and the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he didn't need a pulpit. He didn't need the title. He didn't need the congregation. The world was his congregation. And every continent, every step that he took was, who do I show the good news? That good news is that you matter. That good news is I'm here to help. And I think that that message of hope was seen in his life that allowed the gospel to not only come to life for those who believed in the gospel, but he showed us what an invisible God looked like.
Reverend Jackson, he was known for his work getting people involved and inspiring them. And that work extended to young people, of course. In fact, very young people. We have a clip of him on Sesame Street in the early 70s.
Okay, here we go.
I may be small.
But I am.
But I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I may make a mistake.
I may make a mistake.
But I am.
But I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
My clothes are different.
I am somebody. That one's a classic. Reverend Wilson, what do you think when you see that?
Well, he always wanted to relate to children who had parents. Some of them may be in jail, maybe only had a mother, didn't have a father. He said, Jesse Jackson was my third name. So you can be somebody. I am somebody. And he'd go all around the country, every school he went to, when he went to the jails, when he went anywhere, he'd say, raise your right hand. I am somebody. Mm-hmm. He believed in this somebody-ness. And his thing was, if I could come from poverty with not living with my father, never lived with my father, my natural father, I had a stepfather. If I can do what I have done, he was an All-American athlete. He was a valedictorian of his class. He was head of the student council. He was on the National Honor Society and graduated with honors from North Carolina A&T. If I could do all of that, you are somebody. He said, you may be poor, but you are somebody. And he had that little litany that he went to a prison, a jail, a school, a church, everywhere he traveled in the world. That was his rhythm. Helping people to understand, you have to be proximate to the needs of people. You can't help me if you're not near me.
Alderman Hall, talk a little bit about his flair as well.
Yeah.
We know that he had a flair for fashion, for speaking. He loved meeting people.
Yeah, that's because he was light. As many dark moments as he had personally, you couldn't tell what he was going through. He didn't dress like he was going through. He didn't show up like he was going through because that's how selfless he was. And I think that the flair that he had was the light needed in dark spaces. It was the joy that people needed. And that's one of the things I always remember about him. That flair wasn't just for the cameras. It was for the doorman. It was for the maid. It was for the pilot. It was for the person selling newspapers. His mission, he was driven by a mission to give so that somebody else can gain something. Mm-hmm. And that's what that flair represented, was the endless well of joy and peace that he wanted everyone to get have. And he gave it even when he should have kept it to himself. And many a days when we were asleep, he was up. Many a days when we were eating, he was fasting. Because he believed that if I can show up and give, then somebody else will have what I might not ever have.
You mentioned some of those dark days, right? Yeah. Professor Boyle, Reverend Jackson's career, not without controversy, mm-hmm. right? When you've lived and worked as long as he has. How did he navigate the criticism he received?
Obviously, there was a good bit of criticism at various points in his life. I think what he did was push through that criticism try to learn from it, try to adjust to it. But I think the really big point, I was reading his obituary this morning, I got up and saw the news, and it bothered me how much of that criticism worked its way into, this was the New York Times obituary this morning, because it seems to me that to say that anybody, a public figure, an ordinary person, is imperfect, is to say they're human.
I think Reverend Jackson often said, when he did eulogies, he said, don't judge me by my hits and my runs, judge me by the box score. You have to weigh the good and the bad. And when you look at all of that that happened in his life, the good far outweighed the bad. And everybody has moments where you're not perfect. He wasn't a perfect man, but he was a present person. He was a prophetic voice. And he didn't allow his stumbling to hurt anyone else. He took it and kept moving. We used to laugh at him all the time because he would just get up and keep going. We would be sad and tired. Now we got to go. We got to go to the next place. So he never let those moments bury him. He could see your need and he was going to try to meet it. I'm telling you, he went and got Lieutenant Robert Goodman. No one was looking for that man. And there were so many hostages that he brought back, we didn't even know they were hostages. And so he just kept going for needs.
And
not,
you know,
his own.
The interesting thing is that he never had hate in his heart.
Mm-mm.
I've been in moments with him, meetings on the road with him, in which Reverend arguably had a right to literally destroy someone's career. He had a right to, you know, say something very damaging to them, but he never did. Mm-hmm. Was he disappointed at moments? Was he hurt at moments? Did he share a tear or two in moments? Yes, but he never returned evil with evil. And I think that that level and that standard of compassion is what makes the world heavy today, is because he returned compassion and love in the presence of hate, bigotry, in the presence of people who smiled in his face, but all the time they wanted to take his place. And for me to see him take knives out of his back and to walk out of rooms knowing that that was not a room that they wanted him in, and to never stop, not because he didn't have anything else to do, but because he believed that love can conquer hate. And he believed wholeheartedly that love can change the world, and he lived it.
Yeah, and he didn't do it for money. He didn't do it for fame.
Right.
You know, some people want the stage so that they can be recognized. He didn't do it for that reason. He was trying to articulate somebody else's pain so that we could address it and fix it. He didn't, you know, he was one of the few preachers that I know. He didn't wear a lot of jewelry. He didn't wear a lot of fancy clothes. I mean, we used to call his struggle clothes. He had certain marching clothes. But he was
struggle clothes.
Oh, yes.
Because we knew when he put that outfit on.
We got
the
walk.
Struggle.
Yes.
We had the walk.
And the
a
new
march
balance
is coming.
That and the New Balance.
We were going to pick it somewhere.
So, Professor Reverend Jackson, we're running out of time, but I want to talk about this. He's recognized as the first black presidential candidate to run a competitive race for a major political party. We mentioned it in the obit. What are the barriers that he broke in 1988?
Oh, there are absolutely massive barriers. And the most fundamental one was just to prove that there was a base, a substantial base of support for a man of color to run for the presidency of the United States. That was something, the common assumption in the United States. Mm-hmm. Political wisdom in the United States said that there was not going to be a black president of the United mm-hmm. States for decades and decades to come. Mm-hmm. He proved that was entirely possible. Mm-hmm. And then he created a language in his campaigns that carries into the present day in progressive politics in this really powerful and direct way.
And we're looking at what appears to be the memorial that has appeared outside Rainbow Push headquarters on the south side. Really quick, Alderman, I'm going to throw this one to you. What do you think the next generation should carry forward from his life's work?
I think the next generation, the now generation, show up and serve. He spoke up when they told him to shut up. He stood up when they told him to sit down. The celebrity of him was not lights, camera, action. It was the fact that you could see him working. And I believe that our generation, as Reverend Meek said it, he left a lot on the field. He gave us a lot of the blueprint. So let's continue to protest. Let's continue to identify problems and let's change the policy. We only can do that if we just show up and live.
Pick up the ball and run. That is where we're going to leave it. My thanks to all of you, Alderman William Hall, Professor Kevin Boyle, and Reverend Jeanette Wilson.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities. This story is part of Chicago Tonight, Black Voices.
And that is our show for this Tuesday night. We are a month out from the primary election in Illinois. Be sure to check out our online voter guide to learn more about the candidates who are running, what the offices do, as well as where, when, and how you can vote. You can find it at WTTW.com/voterguide. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Governor J.B. Pritzker is set to deliver his budget address. We're live in Springfield with analysis and reaction. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, righting the heaviest wrongs for more than 40 years.